we might as well get going. Hopefully you're trying to warm up a little bit. So, very cold, right? So we've kind of, the labs got messed up on Wednesday because of yesterday, right? They canceled the classes. So you saw the email out to everybody. That intracellular lab for the Wednesday sections, then we won't do it next week because the lab's already set for next week with compound action potential. But the week afterwards, when we normally were going to have that review in the labs and do things, so we won't have a disadvantage for the Wednesday class. We just won't have those labs that week, except for the Wednesday class will make up the intracellular lab. And I'll be there to help you out, too, and we can speed that up. But we'll review that Tuesday before the exam, right, on that exam week, and in class. So go over your old test bank, go through things. If you have questions, that whole day, you know, we got an hour and 15 minutes or something like that, right, to go over exam questions and get you ready for Thursday. But the Wednesday sections, you don't have all day Wednesday afternoon to be studying for the test. But now that you have 2 weeks notice ahead of time, you know, to kind of beef up. And we'll probably end lecture content for the exam on, this is Thursday, maybe next Tuesday, right? And then Thursday, you know, we'll put that Thursday stuff for the next exam. But Tuesday next week, we'll cover material that will be on the exam. And that way you can say, okay, right here, we'll stop, and then next material. Then if I ask questions over there, you can say, Cooper, I got it on Echo 360 that you said, okay? So, all right, so that can help you out. And if you've got the same textbook and you're following along, I mean, we finished up we're cruising through chapter 6, and we're probably, you know, getting into a little bit of chapter 7, which is sensory. And any textbook, any physiology textbook, pretty much has the same content on action potentials, lambda, time constant, homeostasis, negative positive feedback, you know, all that. It's basically the same. Glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain, it doesn't change, right? It's all the same. So whatever you're reading or looking at, look over that. I gave you some Khan Academy links. I think those are helpful to supplement, to understand, maybe in a different explanation. But some of those, as I mentioned before, Khan Academy is kind of good to get the big picture, but sometimes they really miss the details. Like they didn't really go through the equilibrium potential so much. They just show you the shape of the action potential, but they don't tell you why doesn't it go to E-sodium, for example, right? And so those kind of things gives you a general picture, but don't rely on it fully. Okay, so we're cruising, and hopefully you stay warm. I just remember that how cold it was. I did my postdoc in Toronto before I moved here, and I remember 1 year it was so cold, and they hit the news in Canada. I don't know if it came down here or not, that a gal ran out of a building at University of Alberta. Alberta is like in real frozen territory in Canada. But the university is very well off. The state or the province of Alberta, you know, they have state provinces, you know. Alberta is very well off oil-wise, and so their university up there is very good. A lot of their graduate students are paid really well. But I was in Toronto for postdoc, and I remember reading in the news, a girl ran out of like a gym when she was exercising to her other class. She got out in the cold air and took a real, you know, they think this is what happened, that she was breathing really hard. She hit that cold air and breathed in, and her lungs just crystallized, died right away. I know, starting off morbid. But anyways, it tells you about, you know, that starting off that crystallization of that ice crystal going right through. You can see how bad it is. So if you're out in that cold, you don't want to exercise too hard. But they think she had so much moisture and just, you know, taking that deep breath, boom, that went. Pretty bad stuff, right? But don't you think about all these animals out there? What do the birds do and insects and all that good stuff? We're going to cover some of that as we go through the rest of the class. At the very end, we kind of cover cold adaptation and some really neat aspects of it. So you think about how insects survive, right, through the cold. And when spring comes, all of a sudden, mosquitoes are back out, like, instantaneously. And you wonder, did they all just migrate up from the south? Or were they here hunkering down? Where did they come from so fast, right? And those beetles and all those insects, they survive. We'll cover that. I'm just trying to get you ready for it. Sometimes it might be nice to be an insect to cool down. Okay, so we're going to be covering a bit about synaptic transmission. this guy, Bernard Katz, okay, he is really quite good. He got the Nobel Prize with three other people in 1970. How many were born in 1970? Before 1970? But very, very good guy. He shared it with these two other people, all about synaptic transmission. These other two, pretty much about sympathetic nervous system. So we'll cover the sympathetic nervous system too. But you know, these guys, just in 1970, it's not that long ago, really. But the fundamental break understanding of neurotransmission, you know, in the 1970s, they got the Nobel Prize for it. But it really was in the late 1950s, that they really started to understand the physiology of synaptic transmission. And these guys were the ones that really led the field. Bernard Katz, I mentioned, also worked out the shape of the action potential, right, and the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. So some really cool people. All right. And I'm not testing you on names and dates and who got the Nobel Prize, okay? Maybe that would be great bonus questions. No, I'm joking. All right. But the idea is that, you know, who did these major breakthroughs? I might use the name. What did Bernard Katz talk about? Because we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. So I changed up your webpage a bit to reflect the changes that we're having in the lab. And we're not going to meet that week of the exam in lab, except for the Wednesday two sections to finish off the intracellular recordings. But the Monday and Tuesday lab, you know, got your free time. The week after the exam, we'll meet in the labs, and we'll go over the exam so we can go over all the answers, make sure everybody's on the same page. We're going to do some activities, sensory biology activities, and then we're going to go to the outreach center. Anybody ever been to the med school outreach center? No? You haven't been over there? You've been deprived. We're definitely going to go over there. It's a really wonderful facility, and if your parents or other people are visiting sometime, you might want to go over there. If you're in a sorority, fraternity, pre-allied health, you might want to get your group together and coordinate over there and actually go over there and do some activities. They do a lot of outreaching activities, hearts, lungs, livers, little fetuses in jars, different animals, and it's really quite neat. So I want to introduce you to that, and you know, that you can take advantage of it later on as well. I think the health organizations on campus should be having events out there to help promote that and to understand what's going on. So we'll introduce that to you when we get time. Okay, any questions on this? Some people said they had some problems looking at the movie. You might try it on another browser. I don't know if Chrome works, but it works on Firefox. Okay, it works on this computer. It should work on your university computers. Might not work on a Surface. I'll try to download the movie and put it on Canvas, too, so you have it. But what happens next week on Tuesday and Thursday? Quizzes. Isn't that great? I know you just love quizzes. And it's not a nitty-gritty quiz, but it's to make sure that you start reviewing, right? It's to try to push you to not wait till the night before, because it's already 200 pages in this book, right, that we've covered. You might not realize, but we've covered a lot of content, all right? So I want you to start to push this weekend to start studying and reviewing, and the quizzes will help you to find out where you are. Good. Only when you're in class do you get the quiz, right? So it's not going to be online. Those are for Echo people that are sleeping in this nice cold day. Okay, so we talked about synapses, and what we're going to talk about is how synaptic transmission occurs generally, and you've probably covered this in some other courses, but let's go in a little bit more detail. So this is a beautiful, just want to look at this all day long. Cross-section with electron microscopy, in case you don't know what this electron microscopy, you know, this is a special microscope. We have a good facility here at UK, too, where you fix your tissue, you pickle it, basically, in formaldehyde fixatives. You stain it up with a protein stain, a dark stain with osmium tetroxide, and then you embed it in a plastic, and then you take these very thin sections. And these sections are only 75 nanometers thick. Very thin sections. And you take these sections with a diamond knife. My wife was jealous when I spent more money on the diamond knife than any more ring, right? But these diamond knives are about $2,000. And so it takes these very thin sections, and then you put them on a little grid, and then you put an electron beam through it, and then you look at a photographic plate. And so where the light goes through, you see it clear. Where the light doesn't go through, it's dark. So it's like a photographic plate. So where all the osmium tetroxide stain is where high density of proteins are. So you see these things here. These are vesicles inside of the nerve terminal, about 50 nanometers in diameter. Okay, so that's kind of cool. And then what's this? This is a synapse. Right, this is presynaptic and postsynaptic. So what kind of channels do you expect to be right here on the presynaptic membrane? What kind of voltage-gated calcium? Gave it away. In case you didn't hear it in the back, channels, right? Calcium channels, right? And maybe even voltage-gated sodium-potassium channels to allow that action potential to come down. But in this area, high density of voltage-gated calcium channels. And they now know that some of these proteins that hold the vesicle right there are associated with the voltage-gated calcium channel. That when they, in biochemistry labs, isolate those proteins, they actually conjoin together. And they now know that calcium channels are localized right where these vesicles dock. So why are vesicles way up there? Why aren't they way down here at the synapse? You know, what are they doing up there, right? How about these right here? They're ready, right? So when calcium comes in, boom, they can fuse right away. But what are those vesicles doing? Are they waiting to come down, you know, to this region? Are they just hanging out? Are they made up there? You know, what's going on? So this is what people have been addressing for a number of years. When Bernard Katz worked out synaptic transmission, he did not have the power of electron microscopy. He worked this out, synaptic transmission, by the physiological measures. And it wasn't until years later they actually had images of the nerve terminals to try to understand the anatomy that went along with the physiology. But just to make sure we're all clear about some of the terminology here, so this is a synaptic cleft, very close together. If those are 45 to 50 nanometers, you can imagine the synaptic cleft is, you know, only like 30 nanometers. There's matrix in between these two, right, that hold this together. How does synapses form in development? How does your nerve know to go to the right target? How does it stay there? Is it moving around? How does it know to go to your muscle fibers, the right connection? If it doesn't release the right amount of transmitter, what happens in your brain, right? If not a vesicle's fuse, the communication's all off. How fast are your reflexes, right? All that kind of information, how you can remember something, how you can see different colors and conceptualize everything, your whole existence, right, of understanding you or your behavior, all in synapses, right, to understand how those work and communicate. So it's an amazing topic to understand synaptic transmission because that makes you the way you are and your brain function, right? Your personality, everything about you. So it's really quite neat. So these vesicles have a neurotransmitter in there, and then when they fuse, they release that neurotransmitter, goes across the synaptic cleft, binds to receptors. Depending on the type of receptors, what are the two main types that we just talked about last time? Two general classifications. Inotropic, right? What was the other one? Brain's frozen, right? No. Metabotropic, right? So metabotropic, receptors, transmitter binds, works through a second messenger cascade, then can work on ion channels, right? Inotropic, they are a ion channel themselves, like your neuromuscular junction in you. It's a nicotinic receptor. Acetylcholine binds to it. It opens up. It is a channel. It will allow sodium in and some potassium out. And that's how your muscles, neuromuscular junction works. Depends on the type of receptor. So question that's on every exam, and it's probably, you know, internationally asked in other classes, what makes a synapse excitatory or inhibitory? What would you say? Is it the neurotransmitter? Is it the receptor? What is it generally? And it's confusing sometimes in textbooks and in general information because you hear about glutamate or serotonin, right, or acetylcholine, and what do you think? And then maybe you hear GABA, and you might have taken a psychology course, and they tell you these different, you know, concepts generalized. So glutamate is probably the most generally, the most common excitatory neurotransmitter in our brain. GABA is probably the most common inhibitory neurotransmitter in our brain. But it's not always excitatory or inhibitory. It depends on the preparation that you're talking about in developmental time as well. In development, GABA actually could be excitatory. Depends on these equilibrium potentials for the chloride ion. All right. And we might hear serotonin. Like we talked about serotonin before a little bit. Maybe we forgot about it. But serotonin, we generally think, what, maybe that's excitatory. But we've mentioned that there's generally 14 different serotonin receptors in you, but with alternative splicing, they now know in the human genome, or human body, that there could be up to 54 different types because of alternative splicing. Generally, you think about when you read in the textbooks or hear about on the news that it's excitatory, but actually it depends on the serotonin receptor. In some cases, those are inhibitory, right? So don't just think of the transmitter. The take-home of that divergent tangent was that it's the receptors that make it excitatory or inhibitory, not the transmitter itself, okay? It's the receptors and the equilibrium potential of that postsynaptic cell. One other thing, just while we're looking at this beautiful synapse up here, is that receptors are not just on the postsynaptic cell. Many of these receptors can occur on the presynaptic cell as well. Why would you think they might be the receptor for the same neurotransmitter that's released from here that's going to affect the postsynaptic cell that might also affect the presynaptic cell? Any ideas? Why would you have receptors for the same transmitter on the presynaptic nerve terminal, right where it releases transmission?
Reuptake.
That's a good point. We're going to get to that. So the receptor is not a transporter. Okay, so remember that. The transporter is not a receptor. We're going to come back to that. But you're right on the target, some kind of communication back to that cell. What might you remember from chapter 1, our beginning of physiology?
Feedback
mechanisms, right? Like a negative feedback process. And we now know that that can occur. And it can give some feedback to the presynaptic nerve terminal. And that's really important because sometimes the feedback, those receptors on the presynaptic nerve terminal are different than those on the postsynaptic cell. And they can actually have a different response on the presynaptic neuron than they can the postsynaptic neuron. And that's very important for regulating your synaptic output. And so that's where I'm going to leave it at that point. I don't want to get into the receptor subclassifications, but you can understand then that bigger picture that we talked about, negative feedback for the whole body. Here we have some kind of feedback mechanism right at the synapse. How about you when you're growing and your muscles are growing or your brain's growing and you have synapses? How strong of a synapse communication should we make? Should you make it really strong? Should you make it a little weak? How do you know to grow when the brain's growing, when the dendrites are growing and you have communication? Should it just be that they both grow together? Or should it be that maybe those are already connected, but will make different types of synapses, higher output or lower output synapses with the connections that are there? Isn't that kind of an interesting concept? Because your brain is still developing, and they know that it can still develop even up to like 20 years of age. But we now know that it can still have some plasticity in adult older ages. But generally, throughout younger ages, infant, your brain's making these connections. But a lot of those connections are already made as a fetus. But they have to make the right connections, right? And so you wonder, how does the brain develop? How does it know to have the right amount of communication? Isn't that just wild? It's wild. So you think about the communication has to go on. At your neuromuscular junctions, for example, in your brain, the feedback mechanisms aren't just from the autoreceptors, they call them autoreceptors back, but also the target cell can release factors that can go back and influence the presynaptic nerve terminal. Say, you're here, you're making the synapse, you've got the right amount of output, or you're not making enough, I need some more, and they'll send back a retrograde message to the presynaptic nerve terminal and say, back to the nerve terminal, you're not giving enough transmission. Are you giving too much? Dampen it down. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I just want you to think about all those integrative mechanisms that go on in this. And on these vesicles, this is really quite neat. Sudhoff won a Nobel Prize just a few years back. He should have got it for the calcium protein, but he actually got it with an immune system. That's amazing. He's very good. But you look at a vesicle. So this is just one of those single vesicles that were in presynaptic nerve terminals, one of these little vesicles. And look at all the proteins that they're describing that are on those vesicles. You don't have to memorize them. There's just so many different proteins on these vesicles. And now they're realizing that a lot of disorders in the nervous system and how people's brains work might be lacking or having some mutations in these particular types of proteins. So more and more is being described and understanding how these proteins work. They first have to find them all and figure out what they're doing, and then how do you think they're actually understanding most of these proteins? Are they taking a human and trying to give them messenger RNAi that knocks down the messenger, for example, in that protein, and see if they have a psychological disorder? They're probably not doing it in humans, right? They might be trying it in mice, like a knockdown. But really, most of the breakthrough in understanding how these proteins work is with Drosophila, fruit flies. Short life cycle, they can actually then knock down these proteins and find out if they're not flying well, they're not coordinated well, they're not associated to sensory cues, or look at a synapse between a nerve and another nerve, or a nerve to a muscle, and actually find out the vesicles aren't fusing at the right speed. They give the right amount of transmission, or they're not responding to the calcium that comes in. And so a lot of the breakdown and understanding how these proteins work is actually through C. elegans and Drosophila systems, because of the rapid ability to manipulate the genome and the expression of these proteins. So more and more understanding of humans is really coming from these model organisms. Okay, and if you look at the population of those vesicles, we mentioned about those different populations, some right at the synapse and some farther away. People are beginning to understand, why are there these differences? Why are these populations different? And can they be moved around? Does that population that's way up there, the blue ones, move into the red ones? Or why are they there? Are they just backup? Are they old ones? Are the main ones degraded? Where did they come from? From the cell body and move down? Or were they all made right there in the nerve terminal? So a lot of questions about this, and this is where people are trying to understand. If you look at these synapses, this is kind of crazy. This picture came out a number of years back, but inside here are those vesicles, okay? Hidden back in here. Here's one blown up. It's just to show you that inside that nerve terminal, the presynaptic nerve terminal, is a pack full of proteins. And you think about how they dock, and how they respond, and how they move. Phenomenal, right? There's just so many proteins. And now they think there's, you know, up to 100,000 proteins in these synapses. Some of them redundant, but just proteins in general. And so how they work and how they communicate and how these vesicles move around after they fuse and then move back, it's just phenomenal. So I'm just trying to, you know, get you excited with the field that's out there and then understanding this is where it all is to understand how your brain works. And now think of these cold days, like an insect that's out there and their body's cooling down and these proteins have to move, right? So all that biochemical process is slowed down, right? And their nervous system slowing down, and they still have to function, maybe, you know, escape from a predator or something. Can they do it? How do they maybe compensate? Is there any compensation with cold, for example, at the synaptic level to change how they might function? And there is. So there's really new things that are coming out that are just phenomenal. Okay, so I want to go through some things first on this overhead, and I think it will help. And if I get this done right, it should be recorded on Echo 360, and it's up there, so it should be. So, understanding synaptic transmission. I think if I go through these diagrams a little bit, and this should be recorded on Echo, you could take notes if you want to. I will take a picture of this if it's not recorded on Echo. Did anybody happen to see the Echo from last time? Did it get recorded? Do we know when I drew up here? I'll check. All right. If not, I'll copy these and make a PDF out of it, and you'll have it. But it kind of loses context. So let's just go through synaptic transmission, and then these next 20 slides are all about the same thing, but they're just there to help you out. So we have a nerve terminal, and it could be another nerve. It could be the neuromuscular junction. Okay? Let's figure out what's going on here. Lots of neat studies have been done since the 1950s with this. So we talked about the action potential coming down the nerve terminal. We talked about calcium coming in, right? Voltage-gated calcium channels that are down here. These vesicles that are here, we got some that are up here. We have some that are right at the presynaptic site. These are called docked vesicles, and these are like a reserve pool. Calcium comes in, and then all of a sudden when calcium comes in, these vesicles fuse to the membrane and release their transmitter. Whoa, that's interesting. How does calcium do this? That has been a mystery for a long time. Sudhoff worked out a lot of this. So what he found, let's blow up one of these vesicles. So we're going to go over here and we're going to blow up the vesicle. And we're going to have this protein that comes off. And here's the presynaptic site. So this is this region right here, blown up. There are proteins that are associated with the presynaptic membrane. There are proteins, as I just showed you, that are associated with the vesicle, right? Let's say this protein is inhibiting the vesicle from fusing to the membrane. It's like a brake. It's putting on a brake. Can't fuse. I'm going to hold you away from the presynaptic membrane. This is what's referred to as synaptotagmin. Synaptotagmin. Suffering from a cold. Okay, synaptotagmin. What's really interesting, this is like a brake. Okay? It's keeping the vesicle from fusing. They've now found that there's multiple calcium binding domains on synaptotagmin. So let's just put like four of them there. Okay? These are called, if you're into biochemistry, they might have mentioned these EF domains. I'm not going to test you on that kind of stuff, but calcium domains. And then as soon as calcium binds to synaptotagmin, it causes a conformational change. So it goes from that to something like this. Oops, let's draw it a little better. Okay. All right. So here's that vesicle, and now the protein's moved out of the way. So it causes a conformational change in synaptotagmin and removes the brake. And so now the vesicle can fuse to the membrane and release the transmitter. That's pretty cool. They now made mutations in synaptotagmin, knocking out those calcium binding domains, and find out they're not sensitive to the calcium that comes in. Is that not cool? Or they can knock out a few of those binding domains, like one or two of them, and show that the probability of vesicle fusion has decreased, but if you get calcium high enough, it will still work. All these kind of studies that you can imagine. So anyways, these synaptotagmins are so highly conserved. Many of these proteins that we just showed you, those many, many, many proteins in the synapse, they're conserved in their same sequence from Drosophila, C. elegans, reptiles, amphibians, fish, humans. Some of those proteins are 95% conserved in their sequence of their amino acid sequence. Shows you how important they are throughout the animal kingdom, right? Some of those proteins were also described in yeast. Yeast? What on earth? Yeast. You know, baker's yeast, when you make bread and you make your bread go up? The yeast. And because of yeast, when it buds, there's actually a fusion when they bud or inside of the yeast. And there's the same thing, that there's this kind of vesicle that goes to the membrane and then fuses and it can bud out. Those proteins were described in yeast. And when they started to look at the sequence of those proteins in yeast, they found out, hey, there's a pretty good similarity with the same proteins that are in animals. And it's the same kind of processes. So you can see how highly conserved this process is throughout organisms because of the fusion process. And think about it. This is a bilipid membrane. I just want to show you, think of that cell biology that you learned. And this is a bilipid membrane, right? Bilipid membrane, right? You got the bilipid there. Think of a bilipid membrane and another bilipid membrane. How do they fuse together? Wow, right? Because that bilipid membrane has to fuse into this bilipid membrane. That takes energy, right? It has to break the bilipid membrane of both the vesicle and the presynaptic membrane to get that vesicle to fuse in there, right? So people have actually worked out the amount of energy that that takes. But now you think about, what about these other proteins that are here? It acts like a little zipper. And it zips around and actually pulls the vesicle into the membrane. And that's what these other proteins can do there. So it's really a fascinating process when you get down to the nitty-gritty details. We don't have to go that far, right? But I just want to kind of excite your mind to think about, wow, I just thought a vesicle fuses. But then you start to get into the biophysics of that. That's energy. That's demand. And that's why it requires what? ATP. So every vesicle fusion event is requiring energy, ATP. And it actually, they now know that ATP phosphorylates key proteins in this mechanism to then allow that conformational change to occur. Because of what? What does ATP do to those proteins? It phosphorylates them, right? So that phosphorylation process allows these vesicles to fuse. But also for the vesicle to come off. What happens after it fuses? So we have a fusion event. What happens afterwards? Actually, they pinch back off, have to seal up that membrane, and then they can recycle. Wow, that's pretty cool too. So now they branch off, and they've lost their transmitter, right? So now they have to repackage. How do they repackage? And like this lady just mentioned, student, fellow colleague, about transporters. Okay, so let's think about this. So let's say this is glutamate. And it could be acetylcholine. It could be GABA. We'll talk about the different ones in a minute. But this, let's say this is glutamate. Actually, it might bind to these receptors. We'll talk more about that later. But there are transporters that allow that glutamate to come back up into the membrane, into the presynaptic site. And then that gets back into the cytoplasm of the nerve terminal. But that doesn't get into the vesicle, right? So now there are other transporters that actually transport glutamate into the vesicle. Those are V-glutes. So you get V-glute. That's another type of transporter. You have a transporter in the presynaptic membrane. That's another type of transporter. So now you have different proteins, different types of transporters, and that transporting into the vesicle or even into the nerve terminal, think if they go amok. Think if they're not working right. Your brain's not going to work right, right? What's the turnover rate of those proteins? How do we know? You know, how fast do they turn over? They don't stay there the whole time. They have to turn over, right? And are they turning over at the same rate? How does glutamate get back into the vesicle? Let's take a little divergent here for a second, and let's draw the vesicle. And think about this process. These processes are so fundamental in all nervous systems, but you know, people are still trying to work out the details, and it's not all understood. Let's think about how this might work. In this transport mechanism, you actually have a protein that pumps hydrogen ions into the vesicle. So this is a ATP-dependent process. It pumps hydrogen ions into the vesicle. Now hydrogen ions are really high, so pH is low in these vesicles, right? Some ideas, and it's not well substantiated, but some ideas are that actually this mechanism will take hydrogen out and glutamate in. In an exchanger, so not ATP dependent directly, but indirectly, it's ATP dependent, right? So now if you have a high pH gradient, a high hydrogen ion gradient, low pH, now you can get glutamate to come in the vesicle. This is one hypothesis that's put out there. Now, there's some data that supports it, but there's some data that supports another mechanism, too. But we'll just go through this for generalities, right? But it makes you understand that, you know, keep reading their literature, and you're going to find out maybe they've come up with a new experiment, they figured out how this works, or maybe there's two different ways that it gets in. Okay, so this can then go in. So now we have this gradient, and the pH is very high. What's really interesting, now with imaging techniques, specifically in Drosophila systems, they can, in Drosophila, the neurotransmitter, just like your crayfish at the neuromuscular junction, is glutamate. They can actually have these glutamate receptors with a pH sensor on them, with a pH sensor, and they can image now the neuromuscular junction, stimulate the nerve, and they can see the pH changes at the synapse. Boom, 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 like little sparks. And the pH drops. And then it goes back up, and it drops. And if they stimulate, then they get a big image of a low pH in that synapse. And then quit stimulating, and then it kind of goes back. And then every once in a while, little sparks kind of like going on, because vesicles will spontaneously fuse as well. That's pretty neat that they've worked this out and show a new technology with genetics that they can actually show this. But now let's talk about what goes on here. They think this process, this exchanger here, can be blocked by acetoacetate. Okay, so that's kind of interesting, but why does this really matter? People have probably heard of the ketogenic diet. right? Maybe you've heard of the ketogenic diet. How many have you heard of the ketogenic diet, right? You heard of the ketogenic diet. Why do they use the ketogenic diet? Any ideas? Why do they use the ketogenic diet? To lose weight, right? No. There's other reasons they use the ketogenic diet. And it was really kind of poo-pooed initially. A doctor up in New York was actually working with children with epilepsy. And it wasn't until some, you know, people thought he was kind of kooky, and he said, no, we need to just change the diet in epileptic patients. They weren't working with the pharmacology that they were giving them, the drugs that they were giving them. And this doctor then showed that, well, if we change the diet, and we put them on this ketogenic diet, they stop having epileptic seizures. And people said, this can't be, this is too hokey, not right. But then they found that more and more cases, this was working. And now it's a good therapy to stop epileptic seizures in children. There's a group up in Cincinnati, Children's Hospital. She gave a seminar here about a year and a half ago. Phenomenal work that they're doing up there with children that are having 100 seizures a day. It's unreal, you know, just a horrible situation. They now know that one grand mal seizure in a child can permanently change the brain connections. That's something else, right? It's a high activity. So what they've shown now with this ketogenic diet, and the group up in Cincinnati has done a long-term study now on this, that if the children have a ketogenic diet, it's not very favorable, it's not really tasty, right? Because it's a high-fat diet, low protein, low carbs, right? And it's a high-fat diet. So you think, oh, fat, you know. But it stops the epileptic seizures. So if they put them on this ketogenic diet for a good time, it stops their seizures. They're not on these very strong drugs that can just dampen their nervous system. What they used to be using, and they still do use it, are these calcium channel blockers. Calcium channel blockers, right? If we block the calcium channel here, what's going to happen? Fewer vesicles fuse, right? But those calcium voltage-gated calcium channels work all throughout your brain. So what do you think happens to your brain? It decreases the activity, and they're not very functional, right? So, you know, what's the quality of life? But they found out the ketogenic diet, they were getting the same kind of aspects, but more selectively to glutaminergic synapses, which is the common excitatory neurotransmitter in your brain, our receptors, right? So what happens is that this ketogenic diet, the breakdown product, this acetoacetate, can actually go and somehow blocks this process right here. That's pretty cool. So now you have less glutamate inside of the vesicles, so you have less transmission. Might still have some problems, right? But it's not going to have those high activity. That's really neat. Now they've done these studies in isolated neurons, and they've looked with, they can even isolate vesicles in biochemical processes, so you can actually homogenize these nerve terminals and get high levels of vesicles, and you can actually do biochemical studies just on vesicles. They've used it on dopaminergic neurons or dopaminergic vesicles and showed it didn't have any effect on dopaminergic vesicles in the dopaminergic system, but it did on glutaminergic systems. Now they're looking at different systems like GABAergic, acetylcholine, and finding out if it's more specific to the GABAergic glutaminergic system. But isn't that cool, working out all these processes? And now that's a really good therapy for epileptics. What the Cincinnati group had shown, that they can have these children on this diet for 2 years, and then they don't have any more seizures later in life. And that's a mystery. They don't understand how that's working. Because the control groups, the ones that aren't on this diet, that might be using other things like calcium channel blockers, are still having these multiple seizures. They take them off the calcium channels and actually the blockers, and they actually found out that they had more seizures. Wow, so you can't get off of it, right? Why would you have more seizures, do you think, now knowing what we've covered a little bit? If you block these channels and kind of decrease the amount of calcium coming in, what might happen? They think it might homeostatically try to upregulate and actually put more calcium channels inside the presynaptic membrane to try to upregulate. But why isn't that happening with the ketogenic diet, right? Because if you had fewer vesicles fusing, less transmitter, why isn't there a stronger retrograde feedback? These are questions that researchers are still trying to address today. So it makes you really excited to try to get into the understanding of these details, which impact a lot of people's lives. Okay, so you understand the vesicle, you understand the fusion process, and that's what's happening here with calcium coming in. And synaptotagmin, calcium binding domains, this break, the idea of releasing the break in a vesicle fusion. So Let's think a little bit about this. What happens to these vesicles inside of the nerve terminal? If they fuse, right? If they fuse and they release the transmitter, what happens to them? They can pinch off, like I said, that's another ATP-dependent process, and they can recycle and then get pulled back down to the presynaptic nerve terminal. Well, what moves these vesicles around? What holds them in the presynaptic nerve terminal? Actually, they now know that there's this protein called synapsin. Okay, synapsin. And synapsin, I'm going to redraw this over here. Synapsin is a protein that's on the cytoskeleton inside of the nerve terminal. In the cytoskeleton, it holds the vesicles. And it actually can help transport vesicles and move them around inside the nerve terminal. This is really quite neat. And I found this really interesting because in 89, after grad school, I was actually had a chance to go to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and work for a summer there in this lab that was looking at proprioceptors and crustaceans. So this is a neat marine lab up in Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. It's by Cape Cod. Anyways, it's a really neat place. And they do offer summer fellowships for students. And there's summer classes there that could transfer into programs. If you're interested, you can look that up. Usually students that sign up for those courses and you get in, that and there's international competition for those courses, usually there's enough fellowships, they pay you to go take that course and you're not out any money, except you just get there, okay? You just have to get there. And then, you know, you could drive. And then usually the courses, if you get on a fellowship, people donate money back to that place to have students to take courses. Well, I was in this research lab, and then we were working on lobsters at the time. Great. Lobsters. And on Sundays, the cafeteria is closed, okay? And students have to go out and actually have to forage for food. But fortunately, there was a lab upstairs that was working on squid. So we're in this little building, and these buildings are really old. This marine biology station is over 100 years old. And some really neat aspects. You know, apply to these things. You never know what will happen. So some really neat aspects. So we're at this place, working in this little room that was no bigger than from that door to that here, probably the front of the room, and it's like $5,000 a month. They have to pay rent for that little spot to use it for the summer. So it's very expensive research space. So it works 24/7. The labs never shut down. They work 24/7. People work in shifts there. Okay, so we're working there on this lobster prep, and then we realize Sundays there's no food around. So we save the lobsters. You make friends really quickly because they know whose labs are working with what. But all the lobsters, we just use the legs, and the lobster tail's all there, ready to use. And the upstairs was using squid. So we got together, and we would have Sunday cookouts. And they would dry their squid. A bunch of students from China that work in there, and they know how to dry squid just right. So that was really nice. We had squid, peanuts, and Doritos, and beer, and lobsters. And so that was really fun. But what were they doing in that group? That group up there was actually doing something so cool. They were taking the squid axon, taking it out of the animal, and rolling it like a toothpaste, you know, like you roll your toothpaste tube, and it was coming out, and they would have cytoplasm on a piece of glass slide. And that, you know, you always look at what the other labs are doing. It was so cool. And what they were doing was staining up these vesicles, and you could actually see it in the microscope. You could see these vesicles moving in the cytoplasm, this paste that's basically on this glass slide. So it makes you realize it's not just water inside the axon, cytoplasm paste, basically. And the vesicles move in there. And as soon as they added where they could phosphorylate synapsins, the vesicle would stop moving, and it would come off the cytoskeleton. I thought that was so neat. They were working out, you know, how vesicles move. And then I go off to postdoc, and I'm in Switzerland for a couple of years, and then I hear, oh, that lab just got the Nobel Prize. And, you know, the mentor was never there, actually. They just forced all the postdocs and the graduate students to do the work. But he probably designed some of the experiments. So what they had shown is when they phosphorylate synapsin, the vesicle will come off of the cytoskeleton. And this is what's thought to be the process of how vesicles actually fuse to the membrane down here. But it's amazing, you know, the work that was done to understand these kind of concepts. So pretty neat. And now they know that there's a number of isoforms of synapsins in different animals. The synapses that are in you are very similar to the ones that are in your favorite animal, the crayfish, in Drosophila. And there's different isoforms. They have different affinities, different kinds of, and different isoforms and different types of neurons and different processes, different animals, but generally the same general idea. Okay, so that's pretty cool. Nobel Prize in that. Nobel Prize in calcium with synaptotagmin. Another Nobel Prize in the vesicle packaging because it's so important, it's so fundamental. All right, let's go through some other processes here for a second. Okay, so let's go back to the 1950s, what Bernard Katz was looking at. And he did his initial experiments actually in the crayfish preparation, believe that or not. And then he went on to the frog preparation because the frog offered some different advantages. And the frog was more like you. It releases acetylcholine, and the muscle fiber will make an action potential. So he wanted to work on the frog neuromuscular junction because it mimicked more what mammalian systems are like. All right, but he started off with actually the crustacean preparation, and I'll tell you these differences as we go along. So he did a lot of work in the frog neuromuscular junction, and it's the fundamentals the same as it works in you. So what he did is multiple things. He recorded initially, he did not have intracellular recordings like you have. In the 1950s, intracellular recordings were not invented yet, you know, except for the squid axon. So he used an extracellular recording, a very fine tip, kind of like your intracellular electrodes that you're going to use, but he broke the little tip off, and it was just big enough that he could record currents that were flowing around the neuromuscular junction. What he found is, if he just puts this right here, he would record something like this. Every once in a while, he would record these events. Just random. Okay? That was kind of wild. If he moved it over here, let's say this is site one and site two, if he moved it over here to site two, they were smaller. Okay? Why are they smaller? You know the answer. Why are they smaller? So he mentioned that the action potential, and as you go along, partly right, very good, but they're not inducing an action potential yet in these muscle fibers. So this is without stimulating the nerve terminal. This is just recording spontaneously, just things that happen at the neuromuscular junction. So these are called spontaneous events. And what happens is these vesicles will spontaneously fuse, just randomly. They're happening in your brain right now. They're happening at your neuromuscular junction. Every synapse in your body, in your brain, a billion of them probably, are going on with little spontaneous vesicle fusions. But the ones that you're firing will have a whole bunch going on. But basically, he saw that they could be smaller as you go along, farther away from the synapse, because what this gentleman just said was correct. It's lambda, the length constant, right? Decrement of the potential, and tau, and all those properties that we talked about, right? You're losing some of that through the leak channels. Okay, so now they're smaller away. He found out that was really the case. Now let's go through stimulating the prep. So now we're going to stimulate it. We're going to stimulate the nerve terminal. We're going to get an action potential to come down, and that action potential is going to come down to the nerve terminal and get calcium to come in. And then when we record and we do this, we see something like this. If you record there, then all of a sudden you got these big events. But the event was an odd shape, right? Because these are extracellular recordings, not in the membrane. They were just big events that he saw. All right. And if he reduced the calcium, he found out that they could be smaller events. That was kind of interesting. But if he went above a certain threshold, they were always these big events. Ah. He thought, oh, what they found in the squid axon must be applying to the muscle fiber. You get above a threshold, and then all of a sudden you induce an action potential. And that's what happens in your muscles, and that's what happens in the frog muscles. Your muscles make action potentials in the muscle fiber because you get above a threshold, and you open up voltage-gated sodium channels, and boom, you get an action potential. So he thought, okay, this is like the squid. We've got voltage-gated sodium channels there. We are now activating action potentials. Let's see what we can do sub-threshold. What's going on at the synapse? So then comes along intracellular recordings, and he could do much better recordings. And so now you can have an intracellular electrode inside the muscle fiber. All right? So we're going to redo this. Intracellular recordings in the muscle fiber.
And if you did that, and you didn't stimulate the nerve, again, you got these spontaneous events that just occur. These are called spontaneous events. Events, okay? We'll come up with another name in a minute here. Okay, so these spontaneous events occur. If you move farther away down the muscle fiber, like way over here, again, they were smaller. Okay, and they real small. So cable properties, everything that we talked about. But he noticed something really unusual. If he now stimulates the nerve terminal with intracellular recordings, he could see in the muscle fiber here, so we're recording here, he could see that all of a sudden you get up to this level, and then, bam, you got the action potential, right? It doesn't really hyperpolarize. It just comes back down. Okay. All right. So, again, just like the squid, there's a threshold, like he predicted with his extracellular recordings. But that kind of confuses understanding the synapse because you can't understand how many vesicles fuse and everything like that. So he did a couple of different experiments. Really neat, because this is what researchers like to do, hammer it to death, right? He did his experiment again. He lowered calcium. And then he might have raised magnesium, because magnesium will block voltage-gated calcium channels. It will block these calcium channels here, so not as much calcium comes in, okay? But he could also reduce calcium in the bath. And what he found is he could record things like this. If he stimulates here, he could get this kind of event. If he stimulates again, he might have this. Stimulates again, he might get that. If he really lowers the calcium quite a bit, so really low calcium or high magnesium, then he got very small events when he stimulated. Okay? But what would he see in these recordings? He would also find these spontaneous things that just occur. Right? So he did these recordings, you know, hundreds of times. Right? And then he might have, he has these minis when he's not stimulating, so all these are being stimulated. And then right after the stimulation, he got these different size evoked events. So these are evoked. These are spontaneous. Well, what he did is, and these are all sub-threshold, so the key is they're sub-threshold, because he raised magnesium or lowered calcium. He measured the amplitude of these events, and he measured the amplitude of these events. And I think you know where I'm going. Does anybody remember this stuff from some other class? So he measured the evoked events. He measured the frequency of them. And if he put too much magnesium in there and lowered the calcium too much, he would get a lot of failures. So he wouldn't find any. And these are amplitudes here. Amplitude of the events, okay? Amplitude. So this is in millivolts. All right. And if he looked at these, he would find that some of them would be really small, and he'd have some distribution, histogram that he could make. Some of them would be a little bit bigger. If he had more calcium around and less magnesium, then he would have these bigger populations over here. Okay? So he would measure the amplitude of these things, 0.5 millivolts, 1 millivolt, 1.5 millivolts. And if he did them, and if he had too big of an amplitudes, maybe he'd get some 2s, 2 millivolts. But if he went much higher, he would get to the threshold, and boom, you get the action potential, right? So these are sub-thresholds. So he would look at this population, and he noticed something really interesting. Well, they kind of fit into these domains, this histogram. Well, then when he measured his minis, these spontaneous events, that were occurring out in the not being evoked, he found something really interesting. So now these are the spontaneous events over here. So he did the frequency of them, and he monitored the amplitude of them. Okay, and then so he found this amplitude that was kind of uniform. And when he measured the amplitude of those, the average was around a half a millivolt. Whoa, what would you predict after seeing that? The spontaneous events were a half a millivolt, about, in the distribution like that. Sometimes it's a little more skewed over to the right. And then the evoked events, sub-threshold, were like this. If he lowered the calcium and had higher magnesium, then this would be bigger. This would be bigger, but then he could knock out these. If he raised the calcium and decreased the magnesium, then he had smaller ones of these and more of these, bigger ones. So he could shift his population around. But the distributions had the same kind of general pattern.
So from his electrophysiology experiments, he then said, transmitter is released in packets. And he called it the quantal hypothesis. And he came up with the idea of the quantum because of light energy, a photon, as they were describing as quantums. So he used that terminology to understand how synaptic transmission works. That these spontaneous events were basically from some packet of transmitter, and that when you evoked it, you either got one packet, two packets, three packets, or four packets. Get the idea? So he came up with that transmitter must be released in packets. He didn't have the anatomy to go with it. When they finally developed electron microscopies in the 60s, some of the first preparations they looked at was actually the frog neuromuscular junction, because there was so much physiology in there to understand synaptic transmission. And then they saw these vesicle spheres that were in there, and then they thought, oh, that must be what these packets are full of transmitter. And then years later, you see where it's all gone to. Okay, so the quantal hypothesis, you got to know that. Bernard Katz, how they designed that experiment, and it's really neat. Now, some other things that he did that was really cool, besides just raising magnesium or lowering calcium, he did some other experiments. They finally found out that there was something really unique that was going on in South America, that these people were using these poison darts. And they would blow a blowgun, you might have seen it on NOAA or PBS, and they could shoot a monkey out of the tree, basically, with this little blow dart, and they would become uncoordinated and fall out of the tree, and then they could have food. Well, they find out that that is actually from a poison that's on the frog, and you can actually then utilize it, and they did it in experiments. So Karari will actually block the acetylcholine receptors here. So it blocks these receptors. Okay? So they would put some Karari on the preparation and block the acetylcholine receptors. And the same thing. It was basically like reducing calcium or raising magnesium. Have the muscle fiber that is not so excited. It doesn't get to threshold. And then you would see these quantal events again because it doesn't make an action potential. He did these kind of experiments in the crayfish preparation, but he didn't have the blockers because it's glutaminergic instead. But the same idea. Actually, your crayfish muscles, many of them do not make action potentials. They're graded. So the bigger the graded response, the more vesicles that fuse, right? So that's kind of neat. All right. So you get the idea of synaptic transmission, the fundamentals. That's the fundamentals of all chemical synaptic transmission. What's inside of vesicles is really quite cool because what they found out now inside of vesicles is that it's not just the neurotransmitter. Most every vesicle that they've looked at with what's packaged in there, maybe it's primarily glutamate or GABA or acetylcholine, but that there's always ATP found inside. ATP inside the vesicle. What's it doing there? In very simple animals, they actually think that neurotransmitter, the first neurotransmitter was probably ATP. They're called purinergic receptors, and they actually have a response. Really neat studies that was done up at the frog neuromuscular junction. It was by accident that they actually found these studies. You have these little extracellular cells that are around their nerve terminal, and these Schwann cells around the nerve terminal. And really quite interesting, he used a calcium-sensitive dye and incubated the preparation. So it's a dye, and he was actually looking at the presynaptic nerve terminal, but you put this dye on, it goes inside cells, and you wash it away, and it's kind of trapped inside cells. And this guy, Richard Robitaille, up at Montreal General, not where Albert Aguayo was, what you mentioned before, is that when he stimulated the nerve, and he was trying to look at calcium imaging here, he found something very unique. These cells that were around the neuromuscular junction showed a calcium signal. Nobody had ever shown that before. He thought something's really weird. So what did he do? He put in Karari, right? Because Karari would block the acetylcholine receptors. And he still got the calcium signal. Whoa, what's going on? Well, he thought, well, this is really interesting. It's frog neuromuscular junction. So they don't respond to Karari. So he would just puff acetylcholine in this region, and they wouldn't respond. He thought, this is really odd. Then he went back to these old papers back in the 1980s, 90s, and they said they described that there was another compound that was always in vesicles, ATP. So then he put ATP on the preparation, and he got this response. That, he made the cover issue of Journal of Neuroscience like 3 issues in a row.
with the imaging and the pictures, because that was the first time shown that these cells that go around the neuromuscular junction, which actually help maintain the neuromuscular junction, so they're very important in their properties at your neuromuscular junctions, he showed that they actually respond to the ATP that's released from the vesicles. And they still don't know exactly what they're doing, but they know if they knock out those cells, there's problems in the synaptic communication being maintained. So that's really neat. Okay. What about some other aspects with this that might be pertinent to you? We talked about botulinum before, right? You remember that? Maybe. Botulinum. You know, at the end of the semester, you clean out your drawer and your soup can. You opened it up. And whoosh, the gas that came out. Botulinum. Why is that so bad? Because it's an anaerobic, can live anaerobically and grow. And botulinum can kill you, right? So it's really quite neat. People get Botox injections. You might have heard of Botox injections, right? Get rid of crow's feet or wrinkles in their forehead. There was a case up in England where a movie actress didn't want her crow feet on her, you know, face because she didn't like them. And so she got these Botox injections all over her. And then she was going to act, you know, in these soap opera things. And then they fired her. Why did they fire her? She couldn't have any emotions. Didn't show any emotions, right? Didn't show the wrinkles. Didn't show that interaction, just plain face, right? So she lost her job by getting the Botox injection. I know, it's horrible. But anyways, it shows you also how important facial information is. So when we talk about sensory perception later, we'll talk more about that. But there was a case that was actually connected with UK at one time, about 6 years ago. It was really bad with the ophthalmology department. But there was a case down in Florida where this physician bought, I think I mentioned that, bought the Botox from a supplier that was not so legitimate. It decreased the cost, so he could then charge patients a high price that it costs to get this. But when you buy it from pharmaceutical companies, it's tested, you know, and you know the strength of it. He injected it into this husband and wife team to get rid of wrinkles and all this stuff, and they both died from it. It was really bad. And then they investigated why they die and everything, and they found out this guy didn't buy the Botox from legitimate sources. So Botox is really quite dangerous. They do use it for migraines today. If people have very severe migraines, it's one of the treatments that are now used for migraine therapy as well, because then it keeps the vessels, blood vessels, from basically contracting and twitching in your brain. That is thought to be part of the cases for migraines. So what does Botox do? Botulinum toxins, they're listed from like A to G, or A, B, C, D, F, G, H, up to H now. And so there's all different types of Botox toxins. Those proteins that we mentioned that hold the vesicles to the presynaptic membrane, all those Botoxes, they know exactly which amino acids it's going to break. So they know exactly which protein and where that's going to be broken apart. So if you break these proteins, ones that are on the vesicle or ones that are on the presynaptic side, or ones that hold these two together, and they now know every one of these Botox can actually block these, cleave these proteins. So if these proteins are cleaved, guess what? Calcium can come in all day long, but they can't fuse to the membrane. So this is how Botox works. Why are we bringing this up too? Well, if you can't get these vesicles to fuse, guess what the nerve terminal is going to do? And the muscle fiber. I'm not getting enough transmitter. What does the nerve terminal have to do? Retrograde message back to the nerve terminal. And guess what the nerve terminal does? Grows. It sprouts. So now you have more iteration. So now what do? Get another Botox injection. It sprouts again. Get another Botox injection. You see the problem with it, right? Because it's going to homeostatically try to regulate, and it branches, and it increases the output, and it just keeps going on. So this is a problem. And people are still addressing, does the original synapses ever come back into function again? And in some cases, they're showing that they don't come back into function, but it's the new connections that are made come back. You know, now you're making new synapses. So isn't that kind of amazing? It shows it's still plastic enough, but that homeostatic regulation is really important. Okay. I'm going hoarse. All right. Let's do this. Now we can cruise. All right, we can cruise. So we're going to cruise through some of these pictures really fast. We're just going to rehash these because we basically went through all this. Okay, so here's a neuromuscular junction with the frog. You see the muscle, fiber, contractile elements, vesicles. The frog neuromuscular junction doesn't come colored, but this is electron microscopy. You can see the infoldings. There's acetylcholine receptors here for acetylcholine. All right, you can actually freeze fracture, another technique. You can actually see the little vesicle here fusing. And some people actually have a reference on the bottom of the webpage somewhere. Some of the ideas of these vesicles, it's not a complete exocytosis in this case. After most of the communication, it's not like a neuroendocrine synapse. Neuroendocrine synapse is the vesicle actually fuses in exocytosis. These are fast transmission that's going on pretty much here. Is that the vesicle is thought to make this little fusion pore, like a little neck, right? A little neck. And then it pinches back off and recycles. So some of the terminology that's been used is that this is a lollipop formation, right? Lollipop, right? That makes sense. And other people have used it that this is the process to describe this is kiss and run. So that it kisses the membrane and then runs away, right? So it's like kiss and run or lollipop. So you can get the idea here. So not a complete exocytosis. So this is going through those experiments that we just explained. So I'm not going to go really through this, but you have the slides to help you get through the idea. There's the threshold, and then boom, action potential travels down the muscle fiber. If it's, you know, Carrari, right, or low calcium or high magnesium, you get these kind of responses. Graded, sub-threshold. Here's your lambda, right? So as you go along the muscle fiber, decrements in size. So the same idea. Inflate potential, the farther you go away from it, that's these distances here, it drops because of the resistance, leak of the membrane, everything that we talked about with lambda. Okay. So at the frog neuromuscular junction, they found something really unusual. And this kind of pulls it together. Sometimes this is a little bit hard concept in the textbook. Is the reversal potential. What did we talk about like for sodium on those IV curves? That we talked about, you know, if you depolarize the membrane, you open up channels, and sodium goes in. But if you go up to the E-sodium, right, let's say it's plus 35, and you open up that channel, which way does the current go? If you're at E-sodium, what's the net current if you open up a voltage-gated sodium channel? You're at E-sodium. This is an important concept to get for the test. You're at E-sodium. You're only opening up voltage-gated calcium channels. What kind of current is going across the membrane of sodium? Zippo, right? Because you're at E-sodium, okay? Now, if you went above that, if you went to plus 40, plus 45, plus 50, let's say, and your E-sodium was at plus 35, which way is sodium going to go? It's actually going to go out of the membrane because you're so positive inside, you're driving sodium out, okay? So this is the same idea that they used at the cholinergic synapse at the frog neuromuscular junction. They found the reversal potential was zero. Wow, but we know the potassium reversal potential was like E potassium, like minus 70 or minus 90, depends on the cell. And that E sodium is up here like plus 35. But the acetylcholine, so you puff acetylcholine on and you voltage clamp the membrane and you puff on and you voltage clamp at different steps and they could measure which way the currents go. But they found out if they're at zero, if they voltage clamp the membrane at zero and they puffed acetylcholine, they didn't get any current. Therefore, it wasn't a pure ion going across your acetylcholine receptors. These are inotropic, right? Like the voltage-gated channel. So they found out that sodium goes in and some potassium comes out. Well, then they could play the games of varying extracellular potassium, varying the extracellular sodium, and see how it changes the reversal. And it fits exactly the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, right? That they could actually measure where that reversal would be when you change the ionic concentrations. So basically, this was important to understand the driving gradients of how your muscle works. But you understand all those concepts that we went through before, and this is what they figured out. So it's pretty cool. You get it farther away, more negative, well, you had more sodium coming in. You went up here, it actually reversed the other direction. So pretty neat. Okay. And that's just the idea of the reversal that you even do in your lab. The idea here is that you can excite and inhibit, and sometimes an inhibitory synaptic potential could actually be depolarizing. How does that happen? This is really wild. All right, let's go to this part here. And then we're going to stop here in a minute. Okay, where a lot of this came from is your favorite preparation again, which is crayfish. Classic work, 1961. Doodlin Kuffler. Kuffler, chair of neurobiology at Harvard University. Doodle, from Germany. They worked together on these projects. Beautiful work. It really made big changes in understanding how your brain works at the neuromuscular junction of your favorite preparation, crayfish, at the opener muscle that allows opening of the chelipets. When you're waiting to hold your crayfish and you're waiting to get pinched, let it pinch you. It's kind of fun, right? And because then you think about that opener muscle that's working. And this is where these experiments came from. They found... Okay. And we're going to do this really fast. Hopefully. Come on. Jump. Okay. So they did... And at the crayfish neuromuscular junction, you actually have two neurons that innervate the muscle. There's one that's inhibitory. It actually releases GABA. Another one that is excitatory, and it releases glutamate. Okay? So they did these experiments by recording intracellular electrode inside the muscle fiber. Let's stimulate the exciter. Here we stimulate. And so this is the recording, okay? And you stimulate the exciter over here. You got this depolarization. Well, that's pretty cool. Now let's stimulate the inhibitor. And we're still recording, but we're just going to selectively stimulate the inhibitor. And they might see a little change. It depends on the membrane potential of the muscle fiber. We'll talk about that. So now you stimulate this, and maybe you got that. In some cases, they didn't see anything. Just the membrane went right across. But in general, they saw this. Okay, now let's do something different. Let's stimulate the exciter. Get this, but really quickly, we're going to stimulate the inhibitor. So here's the stimulation of the exciter. Here's the stimulation of the inhibitor. And it came back down much faster. That was kind of cool. All right, now they did something different. They stimulate the inhibitor. Maybe they got a little change, a little depolarization. And then they stimulated the exciter right after this. And they got a smaller excitatory response. So you get the idea that the closer they would stimulate the exciter to the inhibitor, they could block. And if they did it really close, let's do the inhibitor and the exciter, they would just get the inhibition and they wouldn't see anything from the exciter. Wow, that was really cool. And what they found out is basically the inhibitor on the GABAergic system was opening up a chloride channel in the membrane. These GABA receptors are inotropic, and they open up and they allow chloride to flow across the membrane. And chloride could be high inside, outside the cell, right? So, but it depends on the reversal potential. But what they could find out, depending on the resting membrane potential, let's say E chloride was above, let's say the RP is minus 70, and maybe E chloride is minus 65. So guess what? When you open up the GABAergic system, if the E chloride is at minus 65, it wants to go to the E chloride, right? So it would depolarize. So you see the depolarization, you'd think it was exciting. I know this is confusing. You'd think it's excitation, but actually it was inhibition. Because what happens when you get above E chloride? Like the glutamate binds and allows sodium to go in, and the sodium's way up here, plus, you know, E sodium's way up here, like plus 35, right? And this is at minus 65. So as soon as you got above 65 and you tried to depolarize anymore, where are you going to go? Right back to E chloride, right? Because E chloride channels are still open. The GABAergic channels are still open. So you get the idea that it was really important, and they described this, and it's really quite neat because this understood a lot of understanding. Now, one last thing we're going to have real quick. They found out something else that's really cool. They found out the GABAergic synapses actually made synapses on the presynaptic ending of the glutamatergic nerve terminal. And they're GABAergic. So what happens to the shape of the action potential? Here's a great test question. What happens to the shape of the action potential as it comes down the nerve terminal if these GABAergic receptors are open? And the E chloride is at minus 65, let's say. What's going to happen to the shape of the action potential before it gets down to the voltage-gated calcium channels down up the nerve terminal?
It's going to drop much faster.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the big action potential, it finally hits that patch of membrane where the glutamate receptors are open and E chloride is at minus 65. Where is it going to go? Bing! Down to minus 65. So it becomes so low that it can't open the voltage-gated calcium channels that are here, right? And so now you've inhibited the excitatory nerve. from opening up the voltage-gated calcium channels, and you inhibited the muscle. This is what's referred to as presynaptic inhibition. Okay? It was described at the Crayfish Neuromuscular Junction 1961 science paper. When they described this, people that were working in the vertebrate spinal cord that couldn't understand the communications that they were getting in their recordings, they said, whoa, if we think about this postulation happening in the spinal cord, it would make sense. Then they described this in the spinal cord of mammalian preparations, what's going on in your spinal cord, but first, by direct recordings made at the crayfish neuromuscular junction. Is that not cool? So now when you think about crayfish, you're just like, oh, wow. I understand myself because of crayfish. And when you leave the room, I'm going to hand you out these little sheets that you can work on. We'll discuss these on Tuesday next week. If you have, and so try it out. And okay.
And those people that are on the list have agreed to take students. So you're not seeing okay. people that have it that don't want to. Right? It means that they're okay. open for it. Now, they might be full that semester, or maybe for the whole year, but their names are there for a reason.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I could look at what they do, look at your research web page, and say, hey, I read your web page. I read your web page. I really like what research you're doing on mast cells and infusion processes. I realize that this relates to how all synapses work. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool if you have an opening in your lab. I'd like to have some abilities to work in there.
Okay.
Maybe the idea, if you really want to connect in, think about that mentor and he's busy or she, and you know, they're busy with everything in the lab. How to break that ice and get her next? Well, instead of just saying, can I work in your lab, you know, give a whole background of your background and the classes you have. But then beyond that, say, would you mind if maybe an undergraduate that's already working in your lab or a graduate student, I shadow them for a day or you know, time that they're in the lab doing experiments?
Okay.
Can I come in without credit and just kind of see what's going on so I can understand more and then maybe that's a potential for later on for research? But that opens the door, right? Now you're in the lab, they know you, you ask questions, you do your research ahead of time.
Okay.
Read about that topic, and then, person's really interested in the lab, maybe we'll consider her for the summer.
Okay.
Sometimes there's summer fellowships, maybe next semester, you know, things like that.
Okay.
But this is where they get them in the door, get you filling the door, because a lot of labs aren't pretty saturated.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's the process.
Okay, okay. Yes, okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Oh, I think the battery.